1 Corinthians 7, verse 1. Now, for the matters you wrote about, it's good for a man not to marry. But since there's so much immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body doesn't belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Don't deprive each other, except by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I say this as a concession, not as a command. I wish that all men were as I am, but each man has his own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. Now, to the unmarried and to the widows, I say, it's good for them to stay unmarried, as I am. But if they can't control themselves, they should marry, for it's better to marry than to burn with passion. To the married, I give this command, not I, but the Lord. A wife must not separate from her husband. But if she does, she must remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband. And a husband must not divorce his wife. To the rest, I say this, I, not the Lord. If any brother has a wife who is not a believer, and she's willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who is not a believer and he is willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbeliever leaves, let him do so. A believing man or woman is not bound in such circumstances. God has called us to live in peace. How do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? Well, it does sound a bit truncated, and it is, because his argument carries on all the way through the rest of the chapter, but I've split it into three so that we can concentrate quite hard on these first 16 verses. As you know, a pendulum in a clock or whatever it is swings both ways. And if it swings too far one way, it's bound to swing too far the other way. And we know that for real life, don't we? Take driving. Some people drive fast and they like to say, we want increased speed limits and we want to have unlimited motorway speed limits. And other people say, no, everybody should be on buses and trains. Let's get rid of roads. And there are exaggerations on both sides. Or exams. They seem to get easier all the time. A grades for everyone. There are those who want to limit the number of A grades to a small percentage of people. And there are others who want to say, no, all should have prizes. Pendulum swings both ways. Well, the pendulum was swinging both ways in the Corinthian church. Yeah, please could you get it? On one side, in the Corinthian church, there were those who were saying that all sexual activity was permissible. Chapter 6, verse 12. Their argument being that the body would one day die and rot, so that what you did with it in the meantime doesn't really matter. The shocking outcome of such thinking, however, has been incest and sex with prostitutes going on by church members. Paul has had to argue in the last chapter, not for cold showers, as you might expect, but for right thinking. He said that their sort of thinking made no sense, and here's how he argued it. First of all, he said, God is for the body and the body is for God. That's chapter 6, verse 13. Do you remember that? And next he says, God will raise the body to life, just like he raised Jesus to life. So the body matters. Next he said, if you're a Christian, you're united to Jesus the same way your big toe is united to you. Stub your big toe, and it's not your only your big toe that's hurt. You hop around hollering in pain, the whole of you. Well, he's saying the same thing. If you're using your body for sex in a wrong way, it doesn't just affect you, it affects Christ and everyone else that's united to Christ. Imagine the whole of Christendom shouting out loudly, hollering, as if they'd stubbed their toe, or worse, when you look at porn, or your sexual fantasies get out of hand, or you commit adultery. That's what's going on. And then he says the body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, chapter 6, verse 19. And his last argument, more than any of others, when Jesus gave up his life on the cross for you, it was to buy not just your forgiveness, but your bodies. You were bought at a price. So honour God with your bodies. Do you see his argument? He's having to address them, their sexual promiscuity, that pendulum swing too far out to the left, by saying no. Flee sexual immorality. Take care of your body. Don't go uniting it with a prostitute. That's not what your bodies were made for. They are precious. On the other side, however, it seems that there was a crowd in the church that got it into their heads that all sex was unspiritual. If you want to be really spiritual, they were saying, then you need to be doing all you can to steer clear of such an earthy, this worldly thing as sex. And Paul now has to counter that, and he does it by addressing the people in verse 1 who are going around saying, it's good for a man not to marry. It makes most sense to read that as a quote that they were saying, rather than something Paul was saying. More literally, they were saying, it's good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. So for this crowd, perhaps they'd heard the Christian teaching about how sex with a prostitute would be defiling to Christ, and they were sincerely thinking, well, if that's true, then let's do away with sex altogether. In fact, why not be married? Surely that's the best thing to do, the holiest thing. And one problem we'll see is that they were thinking divorce was the way out. So you see, as very ordinary people in the church, just like today, there are those who want to take Christian freedoms beyond what God wants. And there were those who wanted to take Christian holiness in a direction that God didn't want either. And there'll be those in our church, I think, who fall into one of these two camps without too much trouble. In their minds, they'll either be saying, well, what I do with my body is my business. If it doesn't hurt anyone and we're consenting adults, then Christian faith shouldn't interfere with what I want to do. Or they're thinking, I'm a Christian. I need to be really holy. And sex in this messed up world is surely not a healthy thing, so best to keep it to a minimum. Well, what Paul is doing is cutting through the confusion with some straight talking. Some might think it a bit too straight for a church setting, but it's the truth, it's in the passage, it matters, and he's got to address the swing of the pendulum that's gone too far in both directions. It's harming the church. So what does he say then? Well, in chapter 7, it's all about the nitty-gritty issue of sex and marriage and divorce and our circumstances. And I think he says two main things in verses 1 to 16. The first is, have sex, and the second is, stay married. So the first point, look at verse 2. But since there is so much immorality, each man should have his own wife, and each woman her own husband. Verse 3, the husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. And verse 5, don't deprive each other, except by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer, and then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Now that's pretty uncomfy, but very clear, isn't it? He's saying have sex. Husbands and wives should have each other. Husbands and wives should fulfill their marital duty to one another. Don't deprive each other. We've got to acknowledge that while we seem to have quite a lot of young married couples in our congregation, more than we have divorced or widowed or otherwise single people, what Paul is saying needs some careful context setting, therefore. And it's worth saying that the passage that talks about singleness in much more detail is coming in a couple of weeks' time. This is very much talking to married couples. Now, I remember thinking as a young, newly converted young single man when I read this passage, wow, God is very pro-sex. How encouraging. Because my background, I don't know, perhaps my slightly embarrassed cultural impression had been that God was anti-sex, and you can't say that when you read this passage. Clearly he isn't. Here's his apostle saying at least three times in quick succession, have sex. Don't deprive one another. Fulfill your duty to your spouse. But I was still a little confused. Why the need to write so strongly to the married folk saying they need to keep their sexual intimacy going? As a young, single bloke, surely that wasn't going to be the problem, Paul. Recognising the way men and women are made, not having enough sex can't possibly be the problem, could it? But it seems Paul, single as he was, really has a very good understanding of married life. And even if he is addressing the ascetic, trying to be super spiritual and so abstaining from sex person, actually he's got a lot to say to all marriages across the board. He's saying to married couples that sexual intimacy is a must, and often. Going any length of time without sex in marriage is not only dangerous, it's damaging. Verse 2, since there's so much immorality, each man should have his own wife. Immorality. Do you see? The temptation to stray sexually into immoral thought patterns or just bad immoral behaviour can be addressed by married couples enjoying sex together. It's not just busy jet-setting executives or deployed soldiers who have a problem here. They may be forced into periods of sexual abstinence by their jobs and they need to find ways of dealing with that. It's the married couple who, for any number of reasons, may have grown out of the habit of making love to each other regularly. That's who he's talking to. And the same warning is repeated at the end of verse 5. An absence of sex in marriage is an open door to temptation to stray, by Satan, no less, because Paul acknowledges our very human lack of self-control. Work can require long hours, a nasty commute, a stressful boss. It can be tiring. Feeding children can be tiring. Visiting relatives can be tiring. Cooking food, keeping on top of the housework, DIY jobs, seeing friends, they're all tiring. And they all seem to take priority all too soon after the honeymoon is over. And the precious place for sex that God has built into marriage very quickly gets filled with other things. The stereotype is, I think, that it's the wife who's too tired and needs to wash her hair more often than her husband. But I'm confident that it's the other way around in just as many cases. Perhaps it's in the mind. I need to be in the right mood for sex, is what you're thinking. Well, I had a very frank conversation with a friend once who'd been wrestling with his wife's lack of a desire for sex. And what it boiled down to eventually when they talked with one another and with a friend, she eventually realised was a sense that she had that for sex to be possible, everything else needed to be in order. The shopping needed to be done, the house needed to be clean, the clothes put away, the DIY jobs list finished, and lots of loving attention directed her way for a good few hours beforehand. And then she might be ready for sex. Well, such an impossible list she had constructed, eventually she was able to see for what it was, and with a good sense of humour, move on. Verse 3 talks about fulfilling a marital duty, which is a strong way of putting things, and it's a strong counter to the very individualistic view of marriage that we have all too easily swallowed from the media and Hollywood. The idea that I think many of us have taken in without thinking, that I go into marriage for what I can get out of it. And sex is part of that, so sex has to be perfect for me. And if it's not going to be good for me, then I'm not going to go for it. Sex in the movies is two people, lots of passion, a tumble of bedclothes, and much mutual satisfaction. Sadly, it's all too often best served up outside of marriage as well. But where can you think of sex being portrayed in a film as a wonderful and loving gift in a marriage that a spouse can give to another when there hasn't been a shared passion-filled build-up or a shared expectation of personal gratification? I don't think you can think of any. That's not the way it's portrayed, is it? We're used to there being an accepted norm in the marital duty of a husband to protect his wife from harm, and we'd never imagine it's okay for a husband to say, "Darling, I'm too tired to fulfil my marital duty to protect you from harm this evening, so you're on your own with that burglar." No, it's a marital duty, verse 3 to 4, reminding us that our bodies are not our own. They belong to our spouses too, and so Paul has to say, don't deprive each other. So to both men and women, when you married, you said to one another, "With my body I honour you, and all that I am I give to you." That's what you said. But in a busy week at the office, early and late, people to see, lots of telly to catch up on, lots of emails to read, how much is that promise broken? It's just another sign in our culture that sex has ended up being all about me. It isn't about you. My body belongs to Lucy. Lucy has authority over it. If I bow out of sex, then I'm stealing something from her that is hers by right. Not that every Christian couple needs to be the same on this, or that every marriage has to be the same on this throughout its duration. There's no star performance chart that the elders are going to tick you off on as you leave church on a Sunday morning. 3 times this week? Good. No, it's not like that. In fact, verse 5, there might be times when couples agree not to have sex. There is freedom to decide to not have sex for a time. I'm not counting the hard situations when for some reason sex is medically difficult. But note the exceptions, the conditions here. There are three of them in verse 5. Do not deprive each other except by mutual consent. That means both of you need to say, not tonight. Not just one of you. It should only be for a limited amount of time. And the one permitted reason for the time you'd otherwise, for use of the time you'd otherwise be making love is there in verse 5. It's the only reason Paul can think of for not having sex, is so that you may devote yourselves to a bit of prayer. And Paul says, end of verse 5, even if for one evening you do choose to sit down together and pray through the file of prayer letters you have, and for your unbelieving friends that you long to come under the sound of the gospel, and for your situations at work and with the family, make sure you come back together again afterwards. And he's not talking about to do the washing up. There's no good saying, well, the career just needs to come first for the next few years. Nor can you say, I just want to pursue my hobby for a bit and disappear down to the shed, or go out for a run, or another game of squash, or whatever it is. Or say, I need to get 8 hours sleep a night. Or, well, we've had children now, darling. Those are not excuses for not having sex. And then he says, verse 6, even this very limited grounds for not having sex is only a concession, it's not a command. The norm must be in marriage for married couples not to steal from each other by holding back on sex. It's as strong as that. Taking something which belongs rightfully to someone else is stealing. Verse 3 and 4. You thief, Paul is saying to the Corinthians who are thinking it's best to stop having sex. Not only that, you fool. You're opening the door for Satan to tempt your spouse to infidelity in thought or practice because of your lack of self-control. No, sex is for marriage, and marriage is for sex. So there you have it, God's view of sex in marriage. The principle remains. Your bodies are not your own. You are to honour one another with them. Now, one good question should be for the businessman, is this one business trip too many? Should I change jobs because the amount of time my body is being asked to be away from you? Or is that volunteer role I have on that committee one too many because of the number of evenings it takes me away from you and I get back late? Even in the case where sex is difficult or medically hard, the question then might be, what would you like me to do with this body of yours that we can still do rather than give it all up? One application of all this might be that if you've been convicted about not having enough sex is that you're very careful about nights away from each other. A good thing could be that it just might become a little harder in our fellowship to find a babysitter amongst us. I'm not saying don't ask, but don't be upset when the answer is, sorry, I'm booked in with my wife this evening. That'd be a great thing. Paul's point then is that married couples, be content where you are, and where you are is a one flesh, shared body ownership situation where sex is an important part of your life. Be content there. Stop looking over your shoulder and have lots of sex. Just briefly in verse 8 and 9, he says there is a place where you are allowed not to have sex, and that place is called singleness. If you'd wanted not to have sex, you should have stayed there. But you didn't. If you're married, you're here now, so stop looking over your shoulder and trying to be someone else. The singleness boat has sailed. You're married. Though, of course, coming on to point 2, in Corinth, they weren't sure that that boat had sailed, because even if you are married, there is something you can do to stop having sex. You can get divorced. If marriage involves sex, and sex is not very spiritual, then surely I can get divorced, so they were thinking. Well, Paul says, point 2, verse 10 to 16, stay married. Just as an aside, he says something in brackets in verse 10 and verse 12, which sometimes troubles people. He says, verse 10, not I, but the Lord. And verse 12, I, not the Lord. Now, that doesn't mean that he's saying that what he says isn't authoritative. No, he's very happy asserting elsewhere in the letter that he speaks with God's authority as his apostle. The last words in the chapter are, I too have the Spirit of God. Now, what he's doing in verse 10 and 11 is actually underlining when he does that he's quoting from Jesus. Jesus was a wonderful example of how good singleness is. The people in Corinth he's speaking to had a low view of sex. And they were probably saying, well, Jesus didn't get married and he never had sex. And Paul, you're single. So surely it's more spiritual not to have sex if you're married, or if you're married to get divorced. And so it's very handy for Paul to be able to say, the Lord, not I, said this. Well, what did he say? He said, a wife must not separate from her husband, but if she does, she must remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. So what he's saying here is where two Christian people have got married, and there's no good reason to destroy the marriage, but maybe it's come to separation. If you do then finally get divorced, you mustn't remarry, because what you're hoping for is reconciliation, not another partner. You may be separated, you two Christians, but the marriage still stands. That's what Jesus is saying, and that's what Paul is passing on. And the stay married bit is true even if they aren't a believer, which is what he goes on to in verse 12 to 16. The relationship in view there is probably that two unbelievers have got married and one of them has become a Christian. And so all of a sudden everything's changed. So that's the only way that Paul can think of where a Christian and a non-Christian might end up getting married. Two unbelievers, one of them becoming a Christian. He doesn't condone, and certainly from verse 39 seems to point strongly against, a Christian person deliberately marrying someone who doesn't know and love Christ. He says, when a widow is free to be married, to remarry, she's free to remarry anyone she wants to. But she's only to remarry in the Lord, which means another believer. So it is exciting in Corinth. Lots of people have become Christians, but it hasn't happened along nice family lines. There are lots of marriages where only one of the couple has become a Christian. And that is unsettling the Corinthians. Sex has already got a bad rap among them, and they're finding it hard to get their heads around the idea that they need to continue having sex with their spouses, even if they aren't believers. They aren't spiritual, is what they were thinking. Yes, you are spiritual, and you're on your way to heaven. Your spouse is not yet, but you are still a body, and you are married to another body, your spouse, and she or he has authority over your body, whether you're a Christian or not. If they are willing to stay with you, then stay married. And verse 12, it says, if any brother has a wife who's not a believer and she's willing to live with him, he mustn't divorce her. Vice versa, a believing wife with an unbelieving husband willing to live with her must not divorce him. Now, while that's clear and helpful, can you see that there is an implied difficulty behind the situation that there will be when there is one spouse who's a believer and the other who isn't? It's under the surface there, just the strife and the difficulty. He assumes there'll be a pain in a mixed marriage. It'll never be easy. There'll be differences of opinion between how to bring up the children, about so many things, about what's important. He says you can stay married, it's okay. He even goes so far as to say there's a special deal by which the unbelieving partner is sanctified. And there's a special deal by which there is benefit of some sort to the children conferred on them by one believing parent. So if you love them, Paul is expecting that a marriage like this, it will be full of all sorts of difficulties and tensions. There's no easy way out through divorce. If the non-Christian person will stay with you, then stay with them. Now, if they won't, well, then it's okay to let them go. And certainly the Christian who thinks it would be more spiritual looking over their shoulder and wishing they were married to a Christian and so going to do their utmost to wreck the relationship they're in order to be able to move on, Paul says, no way. Stay married. And actually, there's an application here which is slightly unexpected in the Bible. I don't know if you spotted this. Verse 16 is an evangelism verse, isn't it? Wife or husband, how do you know whether you will save your husband or save your wife? By staying with them. Now, the encouragement to stay with them is there. Pray for them. Stay married. You don't know if they'll become a Christian or not. Notice it's not promising that they will. And all of us know sad stories about people who've prayed for years and years, and their spouse hasn't changed. But the application is there's a possibility there, and staying married is an evangelistic endeavour, which if you put that together with verses 2 to 5, there's an evangelistic commitment with a twist. Here's something they never put in an evangelism course I've been on. If you want to evangelize your non-Christian spouse, well then, go and have sex with them. It's the same point. So, if you're a non-Christian spouse here, if you want a better sex life with your Christian spouse, then send them to church, make sure they read the Bible, and read this passage especially. More seriously, Christian person married to a non-Christian, if you have fallen into this Corinthian trap of thinking that maybe it'd be more spiritual to hold off sex from your unbelieving spouse, then you need to go home, you need to say sorry, and you need to get into bed and have sex. Stay married. No looking over your shoulder. No thinking it'll be better to be somewhere else. Love your husband. Pray for him. And stay where you are. Now, I'm aware that I've raised the divorce issue here, and I haven't spoken to it very fully. And I'm happy for you to have a go at questions after this, in a couple of weeks, especially after I've gone over it in more detail. One question you may be asking is the divorce situation the same in verse 15 as it is in the end of verse 11? Is the Bible saying always, always after divorce, never remarry? Well, there'll be different views in Christendom and among the leadership at the church here. My personal view is that the verse 15 person could get remarried. And that has to do with the understanding of what bound means. Let me read verse 15. If the unbeliever leaves, let him do so. A believing man or woman is not bound in such circumstances. I think this is one example of several New Testament exceptions where it's possible for a Christian person to divorce and remarry. But certainly the verse 10 and 11 Christian couple, where they have split because the sex is bad, or they're a Christian couple who've split, the command is not to remarry. They are still married in God's sight, and they're to resist remarriage and to aim for reconciliation. So we need to recap. What have we said? Married people, can we stop having sex? And Paul says, no, you thief, have sex and stay married. But all along, it's been about what comes next. And we're going to get to this next week, verses 17 to 24. The idea he's hinted at so far and will now go on to expound is that everyone should embrace the life that they are called and assigned to. These verses in the middle of the chapter are the heart of Paul's message for both the married and single people. And he'll give two very carefully worked examples to make his point. But you'll have to wait for next week to see how he does that. For the time being, if the pendulum has swung too far in the I should abstain from sex direction, Paul says no, have sex and stay married. Let me pray and then we'll have some questions. Heavenly Father, we praise you for a church where there was a lot of problems and Paul the Apostle wrote carefully and with your authority into those situations. Thank you that we can learn from you through his writings on how to apply ourselves to Christian living today. Please make us wise, especially in this area of marriage and sex, recognizing how relevant your teaching is. And we ask it for Jesus' name's sake. Amen.